Chapter 37. Expecting, I don't know whether I am right in recording that such an unpleasant word had passed his lips, fully expecting to feel himself being, I really hesitate to say, being disemboweled by the push of the long, sharp blade resting murderously against the pit of his stomach, the very seat, in all human beings, of anguishing sensations. Great waves of harmony went on flowing from the band. Suddenly the Count felt the nightmarish pressure removed from the sensitive spot. He opened his eyes. He was alone. He had heard nothing. It is probable that the young man had departed, with light steps, some time before, but the sense of the horrid pressure had lingered even after the knife had gone. A feeling of weakness came over him. He had just time to stagger to the garden seat. He felt as though he had held his breath for a long time. He sat all in a heap, panting with the shock of the reaction. The band was executing, with immense bravura, the complicated finale. It ended with a tremendous crash. He heard it unreal and remote, as if his ears had been stopped, and then the hard clapping of a thousand, more or less, pairs of hands, like a sudden hail shower passing away. The profound silence which succeeded recalled him to himself. A tramper resembling a long glass box wherein people sat with their heads strongly lighted, ran along swiftly within 60 yards of the spot where he had been robbed. Then another rustled by, and yet another going the other way. The audience about the band had broken up, and were entering the alley in small conversing groups. The Count sat up straight, and tried to think calmly of what had happened to him. The vileness of it took his breath away again. As far as I can make it out, he was disgusted with himself. I do not mean to say with his behavior. Indeed, if his pantomimic rendering of it for my information was to be trusted, it was simply perfect. No, it was not that. He was not ashamed. He was shocked at being the selected victim, not of robbery, so much as of contempt. His tranquility had been wantonly desecrated. His lifelong, kindly nicety of outlook had been defaced. Nevertheless, at that stage, before the iron had time to sink deep, he was able to argue himself into comparative equanimity. As his agitation calmed down somewhat, he became aware that he was frightfully hungry. Yes, hungry. The sheer emotion had made him simply ravenous. He left the seat, and, after walking for some time, found himself outside the gardens, and before an arrested tramper, without knowing very well how he came there. He got in, as if in a dream, by a sort of instinct. Fortunately, he found in his trouser pocket a copper to satisfy the conductor. Then the car stopped, and as everybody was getting out, he got out too. He recognized the Piazza San Ferdinando, but apparently it did not occur to him to take a cab and drive to the hotel. He remained in distress on the piazza like a lost dog, thinking vaguely of the best way of getting something to eat at once. Suddenly he remembered his 20-franc piece. He explained to me that he had that piece of French gold for something like 3 years. He used to carry it about with him as a sort of reserve in case of accident. Anybody is liable to have his pocket picked, a quite different thing from a brazen and insulting robbery. The monumental arch of the Galleria Umberto faced him at the top of a noble flight of stairs. He climbed these without loss of time, and directed his steps towards the Café Umberto. All the tables outside were occupied by a lot of people who were drinking. But as he wanted something to eat, he went inside into the café, which is divided into aisles by square pillars set all round with long-looking glasses. The Count sat down on a red plush bench against one of these pillars, waiting for his risotto, and his mind reverted to his abominable adventure. He thought of the moody, well-dressed young man, with whom he had exchanged glances in the crowd around the bandstand, and who, he felt confident, was the robber. Would he recognize him again? Doubtless. But he did not want ever to see him again. The best thing was to forget this humiliating episode. The Count looked round anxiously for the coming of his risotto, and, behold, To the left against the wall there sat the young man. He was alone at a table, with a bottle of some sort of wine or syrup, and a carafe of iced water before him. The smooth olive cheeks, the red lips, the little jet-black mustache turned up gallantly, the fine black eyes a little heavy, and shaded by long eyelashes, that peculiar expression of cruel discontent to be seen only in the busts of some Roman emperors, it was he, no doubt at all. But that was a type. The Count looked away hastily. The young officer over there reading a paper was like that too. Same type. Two young men farther away playing draughts also resembled. The Count lowered his head with the fear in his heart of being everlastingly haunted by the vision of that young man. He began to eat his risotto. Presently he heard the young man on his left call the waiter in a bad-tempered tone. At the call, not only his own waiter, but two other idle waiters belonging to a quite different row of tables, rushed towards him with obsequious alacrity, which is not the general characteristic of the waiters, in the Café Umberto. The young man muttered something and one of the waiters walking rapidly to the nearest door called out into the galleria : Pasquale. Oh! Pasquale! Everybody knows Pasquale, the shabby old fellow who, shuffling between the tables, offers for sale cigars, cigarettes, picture postcards, and matches to the clients of the café. He is in many respects an engaging scoundrel. The Count saw the gray-haired, unshaven ruffian enter the café, the glass case hanging from his neck by a leather strap, and, at a word from the waiter, make his shuffling way with a sudden spurt to the young man's table. The young man was in need of a cigar with which Pasquale served him fawningly. The old peddler was going out, when the Count, on a sudden impulse, beckoned to him. Pasquale approached, the smile of deferential recognition combining oddly with the cynical searching expression of his eyes. Leaning his case on the table, he lifted the glass lid without a word. The Count took a box of cigarettes, and urged by a fearful curiosity, asked as casually as he could, "Tell me, Pasquale, who is that young signor sitting over there?" The other bent over his box confidentially. "That, Signor Conde," he said, beginning to rearrange his wares busily, and without looking up, "that is a young cavalier of a very good family from Bari. He studies in the university here, and is the chief, capo, of an association of young men, of very nice young men." He paused, and then, with mingled discretion and pride of knowledge, murmured the explanatory word Camorra and shut down the lid. A very powerful Camorra, he breathed out. The professors themselves respect it greatly. Una lira e cinquanti centesimi, Signor Conde. Our friend paid with the gold piece. While Pasquale was making up the change, he observed that the young man, of whom he had heard so much in a few words, was watching the transaction covertly. After the old vagabond had withdrawn with a bow, the Count settled with the waiter and sat still. A numbness, he told me, had come over him. The young man paid too, got up, and crossed over, apparently for the purpose of looking at himself in the mirror set in the pillar nearest to the Count's seat. He was dressed all in black with a dark green bow tie. The Count looked round, and was startled by meeting a vicious glance out of the corners of the other's eyes. The young cavalier from Bar, according to Pasquale, but Pasquale is, of course, an accomplished liar, went on arranging his tie, settling his hat before the glass, and meantime he spoke just loud enough to be heard by the Count. He spoke through his teeth with the most insulting venom of contempt and gazing straight into the mirror. "Ah, so you had some gold on you, you old liar, you old berba, you furfund. But you are not done with me yet." The fiendishness of his expression vanished like lightning, and he lounged out of the café with a moody, impassive face. The poor Count, after telling me this last episode, fell back trembling in his chair. His forehead broke into perspiration. There was a wanton insolence in the spirit of this outrage which appalled even me. What it was to the Count's delicacy I won't attempt to guess. I am sure that if he had been not too refined to do such a blatantly vulgar thing as dying from apoplexy in a cafe, he would have had a fatal stroke there and then. All irony apart, my difficulty was to keep him from seeing the full extent of my commiseration. He shrank from every excessive sentiment, and my commiseration was practically unbounded. It did not surprise me to hear that he had been in bed a week. He had got up to make his arrangements for leaving southern Italy for good and all. And the man was convinced that he could not live through a whole year in any other climate. No argument of mine had any effect. It was not timidity, though he did say to me once, colon, you do not know what a camorra is, my dear sir. I am a marked man. He was not afraid of what could be done to him. His delicate conception of his dignity was defiled by a degrading experience. He couldn't stand that. No Japanese gentleman, outraged in his exaggerated sense of honor, could have gone about his preparations for harakiri with greater resolution. To go home really amounted to suicide for the poor count. There is a saying of Neapolitan patriotism, intended for the information of foreigners, I presume. E Naples and then die. Vedi Napoli e poi mori. It is a saying of excessive vanity, and everything excessive was abhorrent to the nice moderation of the poor count. Yet, as I was seeing him off at the railway station, I thought he was behaving with singular fidelity to its conceited spirit. Vedi Napoli, dot dot, he had seen it. He had seen it with startling thoroughness, and now he was going to his grave. He was going to it by the train de luxe of the International Sleeping Car Company, via Trieste and Vienna. As the four long, somber coaches pulled out of the station, I raised my hat with the solemn feeling of paying the last tribute of respect to a funeral cortege. Il Conte's profile, much aged already, glided away from me in stony immobility, behind the lighted pane of glass. Vedi Napoli e poi mori. End of the Project Gutenberg text of A Set of Six, by Joseph Conrad. SETO 6 by Gutenberg Edition.